Good morning and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. And today we're talking about slavery and the extent to which slave labor is used to process seafood. We Americans love our seafood. We consume about 4.8 billion pounds of seafood every year, and we're just behind China and Japan in terms of our consumption. But where does that seafood come from? And just as importantly, when you get it and it's all cleaned and processed, how is that processing done? The Associated Press led an 18-month investigation. They trailed ships, they tracked trucks, and they tracked down a complex web of seafood and determined not only how it was caught, but what happened and how it got processed. And what they found was just shocking. It's a multi-billion dollar industry in Southeast Asia that uses slaves and child labor. The reporters found slave processed seafood actually made its way into products that you will no doubt recognize. Chicken of the Sea, Fancy Feast, Red Lobster, Walmart, Safeway, Whole Foods. Any of those sound familiar? A lot of those outlets actually carry the products that are the result of slave labor. And the good news, if there is any at this point, is that AP has actually, through their investigation, led to the freeing of more than 2,000 slaves, and possibly to directly to an act of Congress, a bipartisan act of Congress signed by President Obama that bans imports made by slaves and children. So today we're talking about where our seafood comes from, and we can discuss how effective the new ban might be in deterring forced labor. So joining me today is the hardworking investigative reporter who was part of the Associated Press team who broke this story. Martha Mendoza is here. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, and she has been a teaching fellow at Stanford and Princeton. She's worked and lived in the Silicon Valley, and she's back home to talk about this extraordinary story. Just so happy to talk with you, Martha.
Thank you.
So let's start with how you came across this story. How did it come to be something that you decided was worth running to ground?
So I'm physically here, but on my shoulders are Margie Mason and Robin McDowell, my two lead teammates on this project, as well as Esther Toussaint. And the three of them in Myanmar and Jakarta had been looking at the issue of rescued slaves who were telling stories of having worked in the seafood sector. And these stories had been reported by The Guardian and Bloomberg and others over the years, where people would be rescued and they'd say, we were enslaved, we were forced to catch fish, and those stories would continue on and say, and the U.S. imports a lot of fish from these regions. The stories were not penetrating. People were not responding. The seafood industry was not responding. No practices were changing. And we had a conversation about it and said, unfortunately, what needs to happen here are two things that haven't happened yet. One, we have to find captive slaves so that people can see that they are currently caught. And two, we actually have to follow their specific supply chain so that companies cannot say, well, we're not culpable. We are very careful about our supply chain. And so that's what we set out to do. And on both of those fronts, we were told it was going to be fairly impossible. Tracking the specific supply chain, one of the experts we consulted with for help said, you're seeking the Holy Grail. But we just thought we needed to try. When Robin found an island in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, called Benjina, she spent a few days there looking around, figuring out what was going on, and realized that people seemed to be Burmese and seemed to be trapped. She called Esther, who made the four-day trip there. There's no flying to Benjina. You can take one boat to another ferry to get on the island. And Esther soon began having conversations with these men who described having been trapped for years and years. And Robin, who'd been 17 years in Asia, said she'd never seen such desperation. They were handing notes with their phone numbers to Esther and Robin, asking them, please, when you leave here, call my parents and tell them I'm alive.
And it took you eventually to Thailand, which is a major source of processed seafood for the United States. What portion of our seafood comes from there?
It fluctuates by year. It has been as much as I believe half. At this point, it's much lower. And I'm speaking at this point particularly to shrimp. It's about a quarter.
Okay.
But it can fluctuate.
And it took you to Thailand where you found them basically hiding in plain sight, these sheds where people are in there processing particularly shrimp. Can you just draw a word picture of what a typical one of these sheds looks like? What's going on inside?
Mm-hmm. They're on busy, mundane kind of factory town streets. It can look like a big garage or warehouse. The fronts do not have signs on them, and there's hundreds of these. They're called shrimp sheds, and inside the workers live in rooms and then get up at 2, 3 in the morning and are called onto the factory floor where they stand for hours peeling shrimp. The kids have to get up on like little boxes to stand up there, and they're not allowed to leave. If somebody has one member of their family escape, the rest of the family is punished. And so people are not inclined even to run away if they could. There's frequently guards. In addition to being very cruel places, they also were, what we saw was very unsanitary. Toilets overflowing, very dirty.
And the conditions that you describe, you put them through the eyes of one particular person, and that experience includes everything from trying to escape and a family member being held sort of as a ransom to make sure that person comes back. So talk about who's running the sheds and how that connects to the fish that makes its way to our dinner table.
Okay. And I should say we published our story about these sheds, including video of what was happening inside in December before Christmas. As of January 1, U.S. importers said they would not bring any shrimp in the United States that had been processed in these sheds. Now, they didn't know it was happening. At least they said they didn't know it was happening. But what we do know is that the major shrimp exporters in Thailand say that they have stopped using any labor from these sheds and that they are hiring these workers. We know 1,200 have been hired from sheds to Thai Union, which is the biggest seafood company in Thailand, and that those workers now have housing, school for their kids, safety, and better pay. You know, we're a month and a half into it, but it does seem like the situation has improved. That said, what we observed and what I'm sure continues in some situations is people who simply are trapped. So they may have made a deal with a broker. You give me this much money, I'll get you a job. Then they go and they start working and they realize they're never allowed to leave. They can never pay off a debt.
And obviously, I mean, if we can say that there's good news that's based on your story, it's that it's quantifiable, that when people find out what's happening and they change their buying habits, it makes a difference. And so I'd like to invite our listeners to call. With so many products out there being globalized, do you even know where your food is coming from? And does it figure into your decision on what to eat or buy? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And so talk, if you will, about how many people we're talking about here. What are the numbers?
Well, there's hundreds of thousands of immigrants in Thailand and in the Thai seafood sector. And those immigrants are mostly not in good work situations. So just like here, you would find undocumented workers there. The situation is far worse. There's far fewer labor protections. What we did find with the first place where we found captive slaves was the island of Benjina. And there was – what had happened there was the fishing minister of Indonesia had called all boats into shore in all of Indonesia's waters. And this is a island nation. And while the boats were at shore, we were fortuitous enough to be there. And the reason she wanted all boats into shore was because she didn't want other countries taking seafood from Indonesian waters. So all these boats are at shore. All these men are at shore. And to prevent them from running into the woods, they were putting them into cages. They had this like big cage that they would put people into if they wanted to leave their boat, or if they needed to leave their boat, they'd put them in the cage. And that's where we interviewed them. When the authorities came after our story, they talked to a couple guys to interview them and find out what had happened. And at the end of the interview, these men said, look, if you send us back to the boat, we're going to get beat up or worse. And the Indonesian authorities said, no, we'll take you with us. We're going to rescue you. So they went and got their stuff and told more people, hey, they're rescuing us. We're leaving. And so more people said, we want to talk to these authorities and tell them what's going on as well. And more people started pouring into this small makeshift office that the authorities had set up on this one day. And finally they said, you know what, we're going to take anybody who wants to come. And they went out with bullhorns in this community on this little island and announced, anybody who wants to leave can come. And people began running out of the woods, out of buildings, out jumping off of boats to get rescued, and did. And the Indonesian authorities commandeered Thai boats and loaded everybody up, hundreds, about 400 men that day, and took them to basically a hurricane evacuation center where they began processing them, get their name, get their nationality, get their age, work with the International Organization for Migration for them to go home.
And this wasn't the first time, though, that they thought that they were going to be rescued. I think I read stories where people thought because they had gone to the authorities, they were whistleblowers, they were plucked out, but only for a moment, only to be brought back. What were those circumstances?
Yeah, people were afraid both times then, and then toward the end of the year when we were in Thailand with these people who were locked inside the shrimp processing sheds. So there was two different times when we observed kind of raids and quote-unquote rescues. And in both situations, number one, people want their money. They've been working, and they have been thinking that at some point they're going to be compensated. It's devastating to imagine that you've just put in all these years and you're still not going to get compensated. They don't trust authorities because in many cases police are complicit. And so getting rescued can mean going from one bad place to a worse place. And in fact, in a shrimp processing shed, we followed a couple straight to jail and videotaped as they took them into a jail cell. They subsequently moved them into a relief shelter, but their initial place was to be locked up, just like any other undocumented immigrant, rather than a victim of human trafficking.
And for anyone watching who might have thought about coming forward, the message was, we're not arresting the owners of the sheds or the processors. We're putting people in jail when they come forward. That's
yes.
the message,
yes.
right?
Yeah, and in fact, Margie did something really interesting. When we had 400 of these men all rescued in this other island, Tual, she passed out a survey to all 400 of them, and in four different languages, Cambodian, Laotian, Burmese, and Thai, and asked them on the survey a number of questions because we were trying to investigate who bought you, who sold you, who brokered you, where did this happen, see if there were some patterns that came up. Did you ever see anyone killed on a boat? Did you see anyone beat up? Were you beat up? And one question we asked were, did you see police involved, and if so, how? And many of them did report, yes, the police actually took me here. Like a broker took me to this place, and then the police drove me here. There's nowhere to turn for these people.
Has it always been so, or has there been an increase in demand that has caused this to worsen, or how bad was it before, and how much worse is it now?
There's been a shift in economies and a shift in globalization, and so it's been a few decades in the making to be this bad. I'm sure that the most downtrodden and impoverished people have always had horrible work and life situations and have always been used and abused. But in the seafood sector, it's been a few decades of increasing the increasing practice of using these migrant workers and not paying them. And as the Thai economy has been growing, they're having a harder time getting their own Thai people to work in their sector, and so they're using these other people at little or no wages.
And has overfishing played into this at all?
That's interesting you ask that, because what happens is because of overfishing, people are pushed further and further out to sea into places where there's less transparency. And that's where abuses can take place with impunity because there's nobody who's going to be coming out and inspecting. And they do something called transshipment now, increasingly, to avoid detection. And this is where you offload your fish to a larger refrigerated cargo ship at sea without ever coming in. And they stock up the boats with supplies. They'll swap laborers. They'll bring in additional laborers. And so the boats never even leave these remote areas, and no one can even know they're out there.
And I suppose that the supply chain is so convoluted that that also is part of the problem in terms of getting a handle on it, yes?
Absolutely, right? Somebody way out at sea catches a fish. They load it onto a refrigerated cargo ship way out at sea, and then that boat comes into a port. You would never know, even if, quite frankly, you're very well-intentioned and you want to know where your fish came from. If you're just buying it at the port, you wouldn't know where exactly that fish came from. And that refrigerated cargo ship may have been out for 6 months doing pickups in Timor and all over the place. We actually, after the rescues at Benjina, we were told by some of the rescued men that several boats, maybe 20 or more, had fled the island prior to the authorities arriving. And so we set out to find those boats. And some people had escaped from them in Papua New Guinea. And so we worked with a high-resolution satellite camera company out of Colorado and asked them for some big photos of huge 500-square-mile swaths of water, which they took for us. And we found these missing boats from Benjina, Indonesia, doing transshipment, offloading their cargo onto these bigger ships at sea. Papua New Guinea authorities rescued those men, took those boats, and then when the larger boat of fish crossed into Indonesian waters, Indonesian authorities took that boat as well.
I must admit I'm shocked, but I imagine that there are a lot of people listening who are also shocked when we go to the store and have the convenience of being able to put those nice, clean, deveined, peeled shrimp in our woks. We don't realize what has happened. So where is our seafood coming from? Have you thought about that as you make your purchases? How does that factor into your decision? Does the ethical treatment of workers factor into your shopping habits? What do you think? 866-798-8255, 798-8255. Let's talk to Tim. Thanks for calling, Tim.
Hi, Renee, and hello, Martha. This is Tim Isgett with Humanity United. We're a foundation that's been working on this issue for quite a number of years, and I just wanted to call in and say thank you to Renee and your call for covering this issue, and a special thanks to Martha, who has done just a tremendous amount of work, obviously, bringing this story to light. She mentioned the New York Times and The Guardian and others, but all of them have really just done a tremendous job raising awareness, raising education about this issue, and it's really sort of spawned quite a bit of response from both the government and corporations and consumers. You know, I think we're all sort of more aware now, and we think more keenly about where the products we are using and consuming come from. And I just wanted to thank Martha for that.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim, and Humanity United. So let's also talk with Lisa in Oakland. Lisa, go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for some great investigative reporting. Although I have to say, I am not shocked. What I guess shocks me is that people are shocked because this is rampant. We can look at the mining of diamonds. We can look at the factories that were, you know, collapsed in India. I mean, I think the fact that Americans are shocked that we live in a global capitalism that survives on paying people as little as possible, and then we're shocked when this happens, is surprising to me. So I guess I'd like you to talk a little bit more about what you touched on, was the fact that globalization plays a big part in this, and also what responsibility do the large corporations that are profiting off this cheap or labor have in this instance.
Sure. Thanks for those questions. I have to say I agree with you that it shouldn't be shocking. And we actually had conversations amongst ourselves of why is it that in 2015 we have to have a photo of somebody in a cage in order to have people realize that there's a problem going on with human trafficking. People like Tim Isgett and Humanity United and Free the Slaves and other organizations have been pointing this out to us for years. And it's not just over there, as I'm sure you guys know. It's here that you will find human trafficking and people who are trapped in these situations. Nonetheless, until you can actually get very specific with the details and evidence, it is harder for larger corporations to truly be held responsible and accountable and respond. Your question about what are they doing, the National Retailers Association and others, the National Fisheries Institute and other major industry groups have all said thank you to us for our work, which had us a little nervous because we were naming dozens and dozens of companies, but not one has questioned our findings, and many have thanked us for being so specific and detailed. They have not opposed proposals that would ban imports of slave-produced items, and they do try to bring in auditors to track their supply chains. At least some of these companies do. There was a response that took me by surprise, and it came from Whole Foods, it came from Red Lobster, and several others, which was, even if this shrimp processed by these slaves is in our supply chain, we want to assure our customers that none of those specific shrimp reached our store shelves or our restaurants. And that response to me took me very much by surprise because, first of all, they couldn't possibly know that. For 6 months, this company that they were importing shrimp from had been using pre-processing shrimp sheds without them knowing about it. And those pre-processing shrimp sheds, the people who were working in there said that they were processing all kinds of shrimp. And so that was a bit of an unusual response, I thought.
Well, I think because we're accustomed now to going to the counter, the fish or the meat counter, and we have to see countries of origin. So you feel like, okay, I know if I know that this country has a bad reputation, I won't buy it from there. I think it's when you see the pre-prepared, like the nice round of shrimp with all of the shrimp cleaned and pre-prepared. It's the processing part of it that is a shock to me. But once again, maybe I shouldn't be, but if you're shocked and you're wondering how to make better choices, give us a call, 866-798-8255, talking to Martha Mendoza, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, and her stories have prompted actual responses from Congress. At a time when it's difficult to get anything done, this was a bipartisan effort to make sure that goods and products coming into the U.S. were not the result of slave or child labor. We'll go to another call. Marina in San Francisco. Go ahead. Hi, Marina. Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead.
I feel like, you know, the issues are so overwhelming for the public, you know, whether it's where your shrimp comes from, where your meat comes from, what the Koch brothers, you know, like their product, and you go to the store, and unless you're, you know, privileged enough to be listening to NPR, you know, daily, you know, most people have no idea. And I really think the only way to affect any change, whether it's, you know, fishing, factory farming, global, or, you know, Koch brother, I'm just using them as an example, but, you know, it's to teach this stuff in school to kids. And hopefully kids, you know, most, doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, I mean, most kids are going to school. And I think they have to be educated. You know, Old MacDonald had a farm. You know, Old MacDonald had a factory farm. And this is what really happened. And maybe those kids will grow up to be farmers and serve their communities, or, you know, go and fish in their backyard. I don't know. But, you know, I really think education is the only way to make changes for just all the problems that consumers just have no idea about.
Thanks, Marina.
Yeah, we were pretty we knew. We had seen, you know, we followed truckloads of shrimp from a shed where people were locked inside to factories and exporters in Thailand. And then we saw customs bills of lading from those factories come into the United States. And on those bills of lading were brands, dozens of brands. And we've published these. And so we, at that point, were a little satisfied, right? We have seen the Whole Foods brand. We have seen the Raley's brand and Safeway brand on a custom bill of lading. But we took the next step and did go supermarket shopping in all 50 states. We have colleagues in all 50 states, and we asked them to go look for these brands, pick up the bag of shrimp, take a photo of it, make sure it's a product of Thailand so we could actually have it there. And in doing this, I did lots and lots of shopping for seafood with my own kids, including one time I was driving a field trip and had all the kids get out of the car at a Walmart because we were trying to crowdsource a whole bunch of seafood. And, you know, when I said, you know, hold it up if it's this species and it's from Thailand, and with their young eyes, they could read all those little labels. There is something very palpable about being in the store and seeing the product and understanding there's that connection. it was striking to me, and it was striking to my colleagues as well.
And it is never too young to start children understanding the sourcing of their food. It's another issue, but now that salmon is maybe genetically modified and not labeled, and how do you start to figure out, how young can you start children understanding where their food is sourced and how it's processed? Give us a call. We're going to be talking more with Martha Mendoza about how her reporting has led to a real breakthrough in terms of legislation to try to keep the slave-processed fish out of the markets in the United States. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. We're talking to Martha Mendoza, and this is your call. We'll be right back.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK, toll-free number. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org.
And for those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. This is Your Call. We are podcasting the show, and you can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and hopefully share it with your friends. Tomorrow, the Media Roundtable, and it's bound to be exciting, talking politics, the coverage and the challenges of this very unusual political year. And you'll want to tune in tomorrow at 10 for Your Call and the usual Friday Media Roundtable. And if you have a show idea for us, drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. On today's Your Call, we're looking at slavery in the global fishing industry. Last week, President Obama signed a trade bill that bans U.S. imports made by slaves and children, and it comes after a series of investigations done by our guest today about the exploitation of Southeast Asia's fishing industry, literally slave labor. Where does your fish come from? How effective will the new ban be at deterring forced labor? Your call, and hoping to find out whether the new ban, Martha, is even enforceable. How do you begin? Where do you start?
It's going to be really fascinating to watch this unfold, and we plan to watch it closely. There's an 85-year-old law called the Tariff Act, and when we first came out with our stories, the State Department responded by saying, you know what? These imports are banned in the United States. We will not import goods that are products of forced labor because we have a law banning it. And I began looking at this law and said, why are we not enforcing this law? They'd used it 30 times in 85 years. They hadn't used it in 15 years. And after much pushing, I was told the reason was because there was a bit of language in there that said, these products will be banned from the United States unless there's a consumptive demand. And this was from the 1930s when they did not want to slow down the economy by not allowing in rubber or other items that they were going to be using for manufacturing here. And so this consumptive demand term meant that, yeah, you know what, we actually can't get Thai seafood from anywhere else but Thailand. It's identical perhaps to some Vietnamese seafood, but it's not the same. And so they had to continue letting it in, as well as many, many other goods which are believed to be products of forced labor. So when I wrote about that, and there were congressional hearings about that, people on both sides came together at least to agree that that loophole should be closed. And there seemed to be not a lot of contention over this. There was some organizations that were concerned that it might make it harder to import products, and everybody agrees this is going to be very complicated to enforce. But it's enforceable piecemeal. So you're not going to stop every product that's a result of forced labor from entering the United States. But when there's clear evidence, Yeah, you can do that. And there are law enforcement from the United States investigators in just about every country, and they can put together cases and then work with U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And I have seen every indication that there's at least an inclination to enforce this law, and my guess is they'll want to have some high-profile enforcement at the beginning to show that they mean it.
Well, I do wonder, because Thailand is a U.S. ally in the region, just how hard they're willing to push. Susan Coppedge is the State Department's new anti-trafficking ambassador, and her quote is, "We've told Thailand to improve their anti-trafficking efforts, to increase their prosecutions, to provide services to victims," and she added that American consumers can speak through their wallets and tell companies, "We don't want to buy things made with slavery." But the State Department hasn't slapped Thailand with any sanctions yet, right?
Yeah, it's almost as if there's two State Departments. There's the human trafficking side, and there's the political diplomatic side, and Thailand is a very critical ally to the United States in that region, and Thailand is not doing enough to deal with people who are being trafficked and being forced to work there. They did, however, keep Thailand as a Tier 3 ranking, which is basically blacklisting Thailand for human trafficking. Last year, they bumped Malaysia up to Tier 2, which surprised a lot of people because they have very similar issues. And there were some who said that the State Department increased or improved Malaysia's ranking because they were part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so there's a lot of different pressures at play, and a lot of different interests and a lot of money.
We have a caller who's interested in talking about the mega boats and what happens when they come in. So let's take that call.
Yes, this is Carol.
Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
A book that I have read maybe 8-10 years ago, author Proust writes about living on the island of Vanuatu, and when the local islanders see one of these megaships coming, they know they won't have fish to eat for the next, you know, several weeks while that ship is in the area. So all these small islands, I think at that time a transport plane would come in once a month to that island. And they don't depend on, you know, any kind of processed food. That is their, there's many of these islands, you know, that the native populations depend fully on the fish. So to me, that stops me from buying fish that's not local. I mean, any kind of fast food or easily prepared fish is likely from a mass shipping operation like that.
Thanks, Carol. Go ahead. Yeah, the mega boats and the fishing that they do, which also include slave labor, if I'm understanding your article correctly, right? Carol is right that local is best.
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of reasons, right, that you're more likely to be getting the actual species that you think you're getting if it's local. But I think that's really an interesting point of, that people simply couldn't themselves eat the fish if it's being exported. There's a very early attempt to have kind of free, fair trade fish. The company was Anova, and it was through Bumblebee, and it was only in Northern California where they were going to try this fair trade tuna, first ever last year. I only saw it in the market one time, but in the community where the fishermen were, there's about 200 of them who had all been trained on fair trade, which is this practice and this trademark, label that something gets. But one piece of their training was to make sure that their own people were getting food. And they would also, another piece of their training was, if the weather's bad, if it's too risky, don't go out and you're still going to get some money. And so those, it was more complicated than just don't hire slaves to catch fish.
Okay. Kirk in San Francisco, you have a sustainable fish company and you want to weigh in on this particular train of thought, yes? Hi, Kirk. Kirk has a sustainable fish company, and he had some thoughts and ideas to share about the idea of making sure that you're looking at the sourcing and that when you're buying local, you know, once again, that you have the species that you think you have, and that overfishing in the other source countries doesn't mean that there's not sustenance fishing for people who live in that area. Let's talk to Elisa in Los Altos. Hi, Elisa.
Hello.
Hi, is this Kirk?
Yeah, this is Kirk.
Hi, sorry, go right ahead. We were just talking about your sustainable fish company. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I run a company called Sea Forager, and we pride ourselves on trying to hold to a sustainable standard. And for those people out there who feel really lost on this subject, I don't know. For me personally, I see it kind of, it's pretty simple. If you're at all in doubt about the fish, if you're looking at your shrimp and you know that it's coming from Thailand. Now there might be a few shrimp farms in Thailand that are doing some kind of progressive work, but by and large you're really taking a roll of the dice if you're going to buy those farmed tiger shrimp or even netted shrimp, where the bycatch alone is just egregious globally. So basically what you can do to minimize the damage or to minimize the risk of supporting something really unsustainable is simply make sure that the shrimp you're buying are caught from your own country. In the United States, the fishermen have to go through quite a few vigorous standards, and also as far as the farming of shrimp goes, and we know for a fact that that shrimp boats in the United States, especially in the Gulf, they have turtle excluder devices on their boats. And of course, this is not a perfect fishery by any stretch of the imagination, but it's at least you're not supporting slave labor, for God's sake. And the other thing you can do is, you know, in California, you've got some really beautiful shrimp. You've got spot prawns, you've got ridgeback prawns, you've got coonstrike shrimp when the guys go for them. These are all trap caught. They're targeted specifically, and there's very limited bycatch. And the reason I point this out is people, in most cases, aren't willing to pay the amounts that those types of shrimp command. So ultimately, if you're at the store and you're looking at a 99 cents a pound or $1.99 a pound shrimp, there's something wrong there. Mm-hmm. You know, shrimp in our area, it's a hard job. The guys have to go out to deep water. They have to pull up pots, and they need to be compensated well. So if you're willing to reach into your wallet and pay a little more or a lot more in the case of spot prawns, which command something like $24 a pound, that's what it takes. So that's sort of my opinion on it. It's not that difficult to look at. You minimize the problem by buying directly from the United States and supporting our fisheries, which are tightly controlled and managed. I hope I didn't just run you off the air here.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, but I the National Fisheries Institute, you know, when I bring this to them and say, you know, maybe there should be people not buying shrimp or seafood from a place where you know that the supply chain has slavery in it, and their response is, then we lose our financial control over that, and then we are unable to bring about change. And so it's important that we continue to do business with these companies in Southeast Asia, and that way we can force them to change. And if we have just simply cut them off, then they're no longer part of the discussion. That is their argument. And in terms of reaching into your pocket, in the middle of this project, my husband's brother was visiting, and we wanted to make him a nice dinner, and it was his birthday. And so I went to the fish counter at my local market to buy some fish, which I hadn't been doing for a while, and came home with 2 pounds of halibut locally caught for $40. It was shocking, and I think that's probably exactly what that fish is worth. I don't think anybody's getting really rich off of this. I think that it's just a high-value item. You might recall that shrimp used to be the center of the dinner plate. It used to be a high-value item until about 20 years ago when they began farming it so much in Southeast Asia. So prior to that, it was a very expensive item, and it has become cheaper and cheaper, and it's particularly driving the Gulf shrimp business down, and they're having a very hard time.
It is interesting. You're right. Shrimp used to be a real luxury item, and now it's routine to have it as part of the meal. Elisa from Los Altos, you had a question about exactly that. How do you tell? How do you avoid? How do you make sure that you don't have slave labor shrimp on your table? So hopefully Kirk answered your question for you. So let's talk a bit more, Martha, about the people who have been rescued as a result of the work that you've done.
Well, some of them have gone right back into desperate situations. Many have not, but that piece of it is that these are impoverished people, and when they're brought home back to their own country, there's not a lot of opportunity there. That said, there have been some remarkable, just stunning reunions. Margie followed one man home, Mintning, who had been gone for 22 years. He had left his village as a teenager and had gone with a group of other teenagers for better jobs in Thailand. They had been in a village in Myanmar. And Margie Mason and Esther Toussaint followed him back. The International Organization for Migration flew him from Indonesia. He'd never been on a plane. He was nervous. When he got in, they were in the car with him going out to his village. He was getting increasingly nervous, crying a little bit. In the village, there had been word that some of these people's sons and brothers were coming home, perhaps. And so his mother and sister had an idea that perhaps he's alive. And, you know, this might be happening. But when he walked down the dirt road in his village and saw his sister, she ran to him. They both started screaming and crying. They embraced. They were literally screaming and crying. And then Margie and Esther were crying. Our videographer was crying. Yeah. And then his mother came out and saw him and just collapsed in his arms. And the three of them, his sister and his mom, just held onto each other and cried and cried. They took him into their house, but before they let him enter, they washed him with like a turmeric water to cleanse the spirits. His mom like hyperventilated and almost passed out, and he was blowing in her face and getting her to wake back up. It was very, very dramatic. He said he would stay there, he would farm, he would live a subsistence life, he would never leave again. He had been through an arduous journey, which had included at one point being locked with a chain on a deck of a boat, and he had picked the lock and jumped overboard to escape.
You know, I think I want to leave people with that kind of image as they're making their decisions about how to source the food. Let's talk a bit more about those conditions. I know it's kind of hard to really be that graphic, but what are the worst of the conditions that you saw?
People typically describe working 20-hour days, and fishing is arduous anyways. I mean, it's very hard work, but even so, to imagine working 20 hours and sleeping for two on boats with rats and not enough food. They boil seawater to drink. Their captains, many describe their captains beating them with stingray tails and other items to beat them up. When people die, it used to be that they would throw their bodies overboard, but there became rules that they needed to bring everybody back, and so they would put the bodies in the same freezers as the fish go in. It was scary, and a lot of the people rescued have PTSD.
It's extraordinary. Let's talk to Mark in San Francisco. Mark, you're calling because you want to figure out, not just in the grocery store, but when you're in a restaurant, how do you know where that fish is coming from? Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I guess my question has been covered. That was what I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
First of all, I was going to say thank you for this very important and troubling program. I wonder if, I bet a lot of people are like me. I rarely cook shrimp at home, but in fact, I was right on my way to my favorite little taqueria to get a fish burrito, and I'm not sure, or a prawn burrito. I'm not sure what to do now. How does one know?
It ends up, and I'm not the expert on this, but it ends up asking the question is the beginning of getting to the answer. And so when we first published about the shrimp, people at Olive Garden were asking, where's this shrimp come from? and people were and at Red Lobster and other stores and restaurants, those questions do get passed on to management. And when, you know, and when pressed, how do you know where this came from, is an important question that management can then begin taking a look and a careful look at where it came from and pressuring their suppliers as well. Somebody going to a taqueria, I mean, I've become that obnoxious person. Everywhere I'm asking people, where did this fish come from? Where did this shrimp come from? Even if I'm shopping at a supermarket, I will ask that. I'm curious, and I'm also wanting to see if that becomes a catalyst.
Thanks. It's a great question. Appreciate it, Mark, because hopefully the idea is, after having read the article and heard from you and your fellow journalists, people will be asking that question of themselves. You can't just take for granted that that fish taco did not come from someplace that had the very kinds of tears that you're talking about. In fact, in the article, one of the workers who didn't want to be identified, who was rescued, said, "We were crying, but we kept peeling shrimp." There was a woman who was 8 months pregnant, and she just kept peeling shrimp. A child fell 12 feet onto a concrete floor, but was required to be shackled to the table and continue peeling shrimp. And that woman who was quoted says, "I couldn't rest, but I think people are guilty if they eat shrimp that we peeled like slaves." Can you ever go back and think the same way about the fish on your plate again? That's the idea. A little bit of discomfort is not a bad thing. Thinking about the sourcing is the idea. So, but Martha, fish isn't the only thing that we consume that comes from forced labor. There's palm oil, coffee, electronics. So does this law affect those things too? And how does the law have teeth?
Yeah, it does affect all those things. Does it have teeth? We will find out how it's enforced. There's not a system of fines or penalties or anything else. It's just simply that it should be stopped, impounded, and not allowed to enter the country. There is a first step that has already taken place. Under the Obama administration, they began publishing a list of products believed to be the result of forced or child labor. And the Labor Department publishes this list online, and you can look and see, I think there's some 300 products from dozens and dozens of countries, and they are all cited, like, here's why we believe this product. And it can be things like medical instruments from Pakistan or cotton garments from Uzbekistan. And so I think that it's going to have to be very specific. They're going to look at these items first and see if they can figure out which of them would be the most likely and try it out. But basically, it's just an impounding. It's a just stopping at the border. It can't come in. And I think that we will see if it has teeth. I think it'll probably depend on how much inclination there is to enforce it.
And with globalization, I'm sure that's become increasingly more difficult, and things are mixed in. I mean, just the shrimp as an example. One particular bag of peeled, deveined, frozen shrimp might have shrimp sourced from four or five different places, isn't that right?
Yeah, and we actually were pretty clear and wanted to emphasize supply chain. So it's in the supply chain. If you have one truckload, one delivery of shrimp from a processing shed where people are enslaved going into a packing house where there's many deliveries coming from places perhaps where there's not slavery going on, that entire packing shed is now tainted with slavery. And so when we saw these slaves in Benjina in Indonesia loading fish onto a boat, we talked with our editors and said, we don't know if there's already other fish on that boat from a different situation. And when that boat came into harbor and we followed the trucks that had unloaded it to factories, again, we said, we don't know what else is in those factories, but under the legal definition and under the definition consumers should understand as well, it's tainted. It's clouded. The supply chain is clouded.
And there's no way to really separate it out, right?
Certainly not with fish. I mean, a fish can change ownership 30 times from when it's caught to when it's on your plate. That's right. And so then you have a whole industry that needs to take a careful look at itself and figure out how to eliminate the abuses that may be tainting a business that they want to have be legitimate.
And as the last caller just indicated, it might not just be a top-down, as in Congress creating a ban, but bottom-up as well, where consumers are refusing to buy and are asking tough questions, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to come from consumers. I think it's going to come from lawmakers. I think it needs to come from the companies, though. Those are the ones who actually have the financial sway to really make an impact. And Walmart sells far and above the most shrimp in this country. And they definitely could end these practices by simply getting very deep into the issue and letting their suppliers know that they would not tolerate forced or child labor in their supply chains.
And even if they do have a country of origin on their labeling, if, as you say, it's changed hands 30 times, how do you rely on even that labeling?
Yeah, it's actually pretty fascinating. When you start going to the supermarket, you can look at two bags of shrimp right next to each other, and the country of origin may be different, and the bags will be identically branded except for that country of origin. So it could be mislabeled for sure.
Any follow-up reporting planned on this?
Lots. There's a lot going on still along the lines of seafood, but also we learned a lot about how to track supply chains. And so at that point, using technology, using customs bills of lading, using satellite beacons on boats and satellite photos, and we want to kind of use that methodology to look at other vulnerable workers and see if we can hold the people buying their products accountable as well.
I think there's certainly a lot to be said for the fact that this required a lot of digging, a lot of good old-fashioned shoe leather, the kind of good old-fashioned journalism that we see less and less of nowadays. Can you just speak to the fact that this required the kind of journalism that we're seeing less and less of nowadays?
Yeah, I have to say I go to the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference every year and have been a longtime member of this organization, which began when reporters came together to solve a murder of a journalist in Arizona, and that was the Arizona Project. It became IRE. The conferences are more and more robust. There's a lot of people really excited about doing this work, but it is hard to find the money for it.
It has been a real pleasure to talk with you, Martha. Martha Mendoza, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, and your stories, your work, has prompted new laws and gotten people to understand the importance of knowing where our sources of food are. We're going to have to leave it here. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your calls. I'm Renee Kemp. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this has been Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the Super Tuesday primaries. After declaring the frontrunners in the Democratic and Republican parties, talk turned to the general election and the deepening crisis in the Republican Party. Who's going beyond the soundbites to hold candidates accountable? Who's providing context and substance about candidates, their histories, and their policies? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Mark Herzegard. And you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.